still no deal on a ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas conflict.
We are seeing contradictory statements coming in from ministers in the Israeli cabinet. We haven't seen any statements on either side that give us a lot of confidence in the process.
Plus, President Joe Biden is in France.
But this is about much more than commemorating the past. Biden plans to use the event to hammer home the need for transatlantic unity against Russian aggression in Ukraine.
And later, elections in Iran, and Poland accuses Belarus of using migrants as a weapon of war. Today is Wednesday, June 5th. And this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Ceasefire negotiations continue in Doha. On Tuesday, Hamas said it would not agree to a peace deal without a clear Israeli position on a permanent ceasefire and complete withdrawal from Gaza. The decision follows Israeli leaders' pledge to continue military operations until Hamas is destroyed, despite the ceasefire proposal announced by President Joe Biden days earlier. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekus-Swara has the story.
As Israel continues its military campaign in Gaza, efforts towards securing a ceasefire face a stumbling block. Qatar, mediating on behalf of Hamas, said there is a lack of clarity from both parties at war. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Majid al-Ansari said they're seeing contradictory statements from Israeli cabinet ministers, and no statement on either side gives Qatar a lot of confidence in the process.
We are seeing contradictory statements coming in from ministers in the Israeli cabinet. We haven't seen any statements on either side that give us a lot of confidence in the process.
Israeli leaders have vowed to continue military operations against Hamas until the group is destroyed, despite a ceasefire proposal laid out by President Joe Biden last week. In an interview, Biden appeared to agree with the allegations that Benjamin Netanyahu is prolonging the war to appease his right-wing base. But when asked Tuesday if the Israeli prime minister is playing politics, Biden said no.
I don't think so. He's trying to work out a serious problem he has.
The ceasefire plan begins with a six-week temporary pause in fighting in exchange for some hostages held by Hamas and ultimately moves towards a permanent cessation of hostilities. As Israel's guarantor in mediation talks, the United States said it expects some bargaining from both sides, but is confident that Israel will keep its side of the deal. National Security spokesperson John Kirby told VOA.
We have every expectation that they'll continue to back this proposal because it is theirs, and it is in their interest. It's also in Hamas's interest. They say they want the war to end. This is a path to end that war.
As Palestinians meet daily destruction and death in Gaza, not many share the administration's optimism. Aaron David Miller, who's now with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
My prediction is that even if both sides accept this, which is far from certain given the politics, particularly in Israel, that if you're lucky, really lucky, you'll get through phase one. But I don't see much beyond that.
Biden has rallied support from the international community, including through a United Nations Security Council resolution to support the ceasefire proposal. The U.S. resolution does not include a demand for Israel to halt its operations in Rafah, part of another Security Council resolution pushed by Algeria. Richard Gowan, UN Director of the International Crisis Group, via Skype.
Vast majority of Security Council members would like to see the Rafah operation halt now. But if the US can convince other council members that their proposal is a credible path to a ceasefire, including a ceasefire in Rafah, then I do imagine that other council members will compromise.
But as civilians' casualties continue to mount, prospects for a ceasefire deal appear dim, at least for now. Patsy Wiedekus-Swara, VOA News, Washington.
Gunshots were fired at the U.S. Embassy in Lebanon, just north of Beirut, on Wednesday. It was a frightening scene for local residents. The U.S. Embassy said small arms fire was reported near its entrance in the morning. The facility and diplomatic staff were safe. However, a member of the embassy's security team was lightly wounded. The American ambassador to Lebanon, Lisa Johnson, is currently traveling outside the country. One of the attackers, a Syrian national, was detained and taken to hospital for treatment, and soldiers were searching through the area for other gunmen. U.S. President Joe Biden is in France to mark the 80th anniversary of the Normandy landing and to underscore the need for a strong transatlantic alliance in the face of Russian aggression. He'll also take part in a formal state visit hosted by France's president, and he'll meet face-to-face with Ukraine's president, who's also been invited, drawing parallels between the current allies uniting to defend Ukraine and the World War II allies uniting to defeat the Nazis. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Paris.
President Joe Biden has long described France as one of his nation's strongest allies, which he underscored by granting France his administration's first invitation for his state visit in 2022. Now it's time for France to return his hospitality, as Biden marks the 80th anniversary of the massive, decisive Allied assault that changed the course of history.
The president's very much looking forward to going to Normandy over the course of the last 2 days of this week to commemorate the service and the sacrifice, the bravery of the soldiers, Allied and American alike, who fought in D-Day in that invasion, conducted Operation Overlord, and really spelled through that operation the beginning of the end of Nazi Germany and the beginning of something even more impactful, and that's this rules-based international order that we all still continue to enjoy today.
But this is about much more than commemorating the past. Biden plans to use the event to hammer home the need for transatlantic unity against Russian aggression in Ukraine. Here, analysts say, history offers lessons.
The D-Day landings were the Western allies' statement, military statement, that authoritarian regimes could not change boundaries by force, that countries could not just be invaded, and that authoritarian regimes of the type that Nazi Germany constituted, particularly with its terrible oppression of subject peoples, particularly the Jews, were not acceptable. And not just not acceptable, but would be destroyed.
But analysts say Biden's Ukraine goals will be overshadowed by his increasingly unpopular support of another conflict.
Even though obviously Ukraine is the top priority for the Europeans, they are seeing how the Biden administration's policy on Gaza is undermining European security in two different ways. First of all, it is really destroying Western credibility in the broader international community and in the global South. Any talk about the rules-based international order at this point will be laughed at, given what the Biden administration has done.
This high-level diplomacy is, at the best of times, a challenge for any world leader. At the worst of times, it can foment conflict. This trip launches a summer full of high-stakes summits aimed at soothing worldwide tensions and answering the question, what times lie ahead of us? Anita Powell, VOA News, Paris.
And speaking of D-Day, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is set to participate in events to mark the anniversary of the Normandy invasion this week, and he'll participate in the G7 summit next week. But meanwhile, at home in Ukraine, the country struggles under electricity outages caused by Russian attacks. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
The deficit in the Ukrainian energy system is significant. This, according to Volodymyr Kudrytsky, the chairman of Ukrenergo, Ukraine's major energy company. In this regard, scheduled power outages across Ukraine will be longer. The emergency shutdowns will be activated in various regions across the country to stabilize the power load. Currently, the situation with electricity in Ukraine is already close to critical. In some regions, there is no electricity for most of the day. In Kyiv, on average, there is no electricity for 4 to 5 hours a day. In the Kyiv region outside the city, the situation is worse. People are forced to adapt to blackouts lasting for 7 to 8 hours a day. Russia continues to focus its attacks on critical infrastructure facilities in Ukraine. The main targets are the energy-generating facilities and energy production infrastructure. Meanwhile, President Zelensky will participate in the G7 summit in Italy, which will take place from June 13th to June 15th. The president's spokesman confirmed his participation and announced that during the summit, Zelensky intends to discuss with the U.S. the further increase of defense support, the development of a coalition of Western fighter jets, and steps to accelerate the supply of F-16s. Also, one of the key topics will be the strengthening of Ukrainian air defense with additional systems and missiles. In a couple of days, on June 7th, French President Emmanuel Macron will receive Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky at the Elysee Palace. Zelensky will take part in the events to mark Allied forces landing in Normandy, 80th D-Day anniversary. President Macron said in a series of recent statements that France could send military instructors to Ukraine. Some analysts believe that Paris may announce such a decision on the occasion of Zelensky's visit, despite concerns from some allies and criticism from Russia. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. A look at the upcoming election in Iran coming up, but first we continue our look at Europe. The Polish government has increased security on its border with Belarus amid recent violence between soldiers and immigrants. In fact, Poland sees the latest influx of migrants coming from Belarus as a hybrid warfare tactic. VOA's Eastern Europe bureau chief Miroslava Gongadze visited the area and has this report.
On the border between Poland and Belarus, the Belovezha Forest, popular with tourists and nature lovers, has been a site of recent clashes between Polish soldiers and migrants, prompting Poland to reintroduce a 200-meter buffer zone. The area has been partly divided by this fence since 2021, when Poland first faced an influx of migrants from Belarus. At the time, the Polish government accused Belarus of using migrants, some from the Middle East, as a hybrid war tactic to destabilize the situation at the border with the European Union and NATO. Michal Bura, a senior staff officer with the Polish border guard, says this time the violence at the border has increased.
The situation at the border is very dangerous. Every day we have a few hundred incidents of illegal crossing. Migrants are very aggressive and attacking Polish border guards.
Just last week, the Polish border guards were treated in the hospital after sustaining injuries at the border from attacks by migrants, that including a stabbing. Again, Polish border guard Michal Bura.
This migration is artificially directed. Governments in Moscow or Minsk are deciding when and how many people to push through the border. This is not a natural migration process. This is one of the elements of the hybrid war. This is a test of our strength, capabilities, and distraction from the war in Ukraine.
VOA reached out to officials at the Belarusian embassy in Poland for comments and received no immediate response. Belarusian officials have rejected accusations that their country has been helping channel migrants to the Polish border. After visiting this area recently, Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk announced the reintroduction of the 200-meter buffer zone along the border that was established in 2001 and lifted a year later when the border fence was completed. Olivia Hurley is a volunteer with the Granica Group, which helps the migrants on the border and monitors human rights violations. She says the migrants are being used as a pawns by Belarus.
Yeah, they want to get to European Union. They don't want to get arrested and put in jail for killing, for example, a Polish soldier or Polish border guard. But it makes a lot of sense from a Belarusian point of view because they've tried many times to provoke Polish army and Polish border guards into combat.
Hurley recalls migrants telling stories of the severe brutality they endure in Belarus.
The beatings, the rapes, the starving people. High level of briberies. That's why they beg Polish forces not to push them back to Belarus.
Hurley showed us a border of the buffer zone. She says the zone will not fix the problem and could hurt local businesses.
You allowed to be on this road, but on the other side, around 50 meters into the forest, the invisible line that you cannot cross.
Tourists have already started canceling their plans to visit the area. Hurley and others say there needs to be a complex solution that will secure the border and also protect the human rights of the asylum seekers. Мирослава Гонгадзе, VOA News, Невлевка, Poland.
Now to Iran. Dozens of loyalists of Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei have registered their candidacies for a snap June 28th election to replace the late president, Ibrahim Raisi. Raisi died in a helicopter crash last month. The registered candidates for his position will be vetted by a pro-Khamenei council that typically disqualifies those not favored by him. Raisi faced no serious opponents when he won a 2021 election that drew widespread voter apathy and record low turnout. The current election is already drawing cynicism from social media users in Iran. My colleague Michael Lippin spoke with VOA Persian multimedia journalist Saghi Lagahi and asked her why such a prominent former official would join in the criticism of the election.
Michael, this election is not really particularly different from others in the past 45 years in Iran. According to political observers, it's always a show instead of a real democratic event. Now, what Karbosci says as a former official of the Islamic regime, he admits the election is like a comedy or joke. It shows that the campaign, which aimed to boycott the previous election, has been very successful, and it continues as a public discourse. I think it's important that even politicians who are close to the regime and work for the regime use the same term to show themselves close to the people.
Well, another social media post that you highlighted was much stronger, and this is from the mother of Nika Shakarami, who is a young teenage girl killed in the Mahsa Amini Woman Life Freedom protests back in 2022. And her mother, Nasreen, called the regime evil on Instagram and said anyone who participates in this election is an accomplice to evil. So how typical is this kind of strong language from an Instagram user who is inside Iran?
You know, Michael, in recent years, we see that more people in Iran speak their opinions without any fear. And this is clearly seen in the slogans of protesters and even social media posts. However, there is still the risk of arrest or pressures or even a risk of life for them. But people like Nasreen Shakarami or Fatemeh Sepehri, who is in prison right now, talk clearly against the regime and say that Islamic Republic must go.
Well, it's interesting that you mention some Iranians don't show a lot of fear in expressing their view about the Iranian government. But the government, as we know, has been cracking down on social media posting that they don't like, especially after the death of Ibrahim Raisi. There were reports of authorities summoning people for questioning and ordering people to take down posts that made fun of the late president. So do you see this crackdown having any impact right now on what people are saying about this election?
Even officials arrested some people because of what you said. But it's obvious that there are no more fear in people, especially in new generation. They speak their opinions very clearly. No to Islamic Republic. It seems nothing can stop them from what they want for Iran, which is freedom and democracy.
That's VOA's Michael Lippin speaking with Saghi Lagahi of VOA's Persian service. And finally today, a growing crisis in the United States as America prepares for its own upcoming election in November. A report released Tuesday says hate and extremism in the United States rose in 2023, with record numbers of white nationalists and anti-LGBTQ groups trying to undermine the country's inclusive democracy. VOA's Veronica Balderas-Iglesias breaks down the researchers' findings and the implications for the presidential election.
The LGBTQ plus community was one of the primary targets of hate and extremism in the U.S. in 2023, according to a report released Tuesday by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Researchers say hate-filled rhetoric and anti-government conspiracy theories also negatively affected immigrants, people of color, and minority faith communities. R.G. Cravens is a senior research analyst at the Southern Poverty Law Center. He spoke to VOA via Skype.
Extremists, those who oppose inclusive democracy, spent the last year legitimizing insurrection, painting hate as virtuous, and transforming conspiracy theories into mainstream narratives. And they're all in preparation, I would say, towards one of the most significant elections in our history.
A total of 835 anti-government groups were active last year, up from 702 the previous year. The report found the number of active hate groups in the U.S. rose to 595 last year, up from 523 in the previous year. Craven says the groups are moving into the political realm with a specific goal.
To limit pluralism, it's to limit participation, it's to limit democracy itself.
U.S. President Joe Biden presents himself as the only viable option in the November presidential election to stop a rise in hate-filled rhetoric.
We're not going to let Donald Trump turn America into a place that doesn't believe in honesty, decency, and treating people with respect. And I'll be damned if I'm going to let Donald Trump turn America into a place filled with anger and resentment and hate.
Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee, sparked controversy when, as president, he blamed both sides for violent clashes at a 2017 white nationalist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, that broke out between protesters and counter-protesters. During the demonstration, a white supremacist intentionally drove his car into a crowd of counter-protesters, killing one woman and injuring more than 30 people. Then President Trump addressed the violence, calling it an egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. Trump has sided with groups at the forefront of book bans, such as Moms for Liberty, which the Southern Poverty Law Center listed again in 2023 as an anti-government extremist group opposed to inclusive education.
The radical left is even slandering Moms for Liberty as a so-called hate group. You're a hate group. Can you imagine? Moms for Liberty, hate group.
Moms for Liberty declined VOA's interview request. Experts say candidates must be careful about the rhetoric to quell any potential violence ahead of the November general election. Teal Rothschild is a sociology professor at Roger Williams University.
For Biden to continue to be present and speak about peace, but also the importance of voting generally. In terms of former President Trump, he's in a tricky spot because he certainly does garner more support when he uses some of this extremist language. But as a result, he's also marginalizing populations that might vote.
Rothschild also suggests voters watch out for conspiracy theories on mainstream and social media that may further fuel hate and extremism. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
And that's going to wrap up today's program. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.